Hi friends, this is Ajit Kumar and I am going to read to you the book History and Principles of Literary Criticism. The first chapter in this book is Greek Criticism, Aristotle. The time period of Aristotle is from 384 to 322 BC. First, let us look at the career and works of Aristotle. Aristotle was born in 384 BC at Stagira. He came to Athens at the age of 17 and became a disciple of Plato. He stayed with his master till his death in 347 BC. Thereafter, he went to Asia Minor and became a teacher there. He studied biology for 2 years and in 342 BC became the tutor to Prince Alexander of Macedon. In 335 BC, he founded the Peripatetic School where he delivered lectures on diverse subjects. He died in 322 BC. He was a voluminous writer and has about 400 volumes to his credit. The more important of his books are, first is Dialogues, second On Monarchy, third Natural History, fourth Organon or The Instrument of Correct Thinking, fifth Rhetoric, 6th Logic, 7th Educational Ethics, 8th Nicomachean Ethics, 9th Physics, 10th Metaphysics, and 11th Politics, and 12th Poetics. Now the next heading is The Poetics, Its Plan, Brief Synopsis, Value and Significance, Some Shortcomings. Aristotle is the first scientific literary critic and his literary criticism is largely embodied in the Poetics, which must have been penned by him after he settled as teacher and investigator in Athens. The Poetics is a short treatise of 26 chapters and 45 pages, neither exhaustive and comprehensive, nor yet a coherent treatment of the subject with which it deals. It doesn't seem to be a work intended for publication. It doesn't say much about comedy, touches rather briefly on the epic and the renowned concept of catharsis has not been fully developed or explained. It is a lopsided work concerned mainly with the Greek philosopher's theory of tragedy. The next heading is Plan. That is the plan of the book Poetics. The Poetics is divisible into the following 6 parts. First, chapters from 1 to 5 contain introductory remarks on poetry and its classification into different kinds, including tragedy and comedy. Imitation is said to be the basic principle common to all the arts. Second, the next 14 chapters from chapter 6 to 19 are devoted to tragedy. A definition is given and its formative elements are discussed. Third, the next 3 chapters from 20 to 22 are devoted to a discussion of poetic diction, style, vocabulary, etc. Fourth, chapter 23 deals with narrative poetry and tragedy. The epic is treated in brief and compared with tragedy in chapters 24 and 26. Then sixth, chapter 25 examines the objections of critics against poetry. The objections are also answered. Commenting on the scheme and plan of the poetics, Abercrombie, Abercrombie, writes that the subject matter of the poetics is not merely restricted to Greek literature but also to certain kinds of Greek literature. These are four in number, and Aristotle groups them in pairs according to their historical and aesthetic connexions, connexions. He supposes poetry to begin in two kinds, either as heroic or as satiric poetry, satiric. But out of satiric comes comedy, and out of heroic or epic comes tragedy. Since the nature of poetry thus disposes itself into two pairs or kinds, the principles valid for epic will, with proper modifications, be valid also for tragedy. Those applicable to satire will be similarly applicable to comedy. But Aristotle regarded the historically latter kind in each pair as a higher development of poetic art, and as therefore requiring fuller discussion than earlier kind. Accordingly, his scheme is to work out the theory of the latter development and then apply it to the earlier kind. But the poetics as we have it is not complete. The scheme of the discussion is unmistakably indicated, but actually we are only given the discussion of tragedy and the application of its results to epic poetry. There can be no doubt that the original treatise contained a second part, now lost, in which comedy and satire were similarly treated. Now, another subheading is some defects. The work is in the nature of class notes of an intelligent teacher and has contain obvious defects. The first one is the handling of the subject is disproportionate. Second, lyric poetry has been practically ignored, probably because A. it was thought to constitute an elementary stage in poetic development. B. it was supposed to belong to the domain of music and not poetry proper. And C. it was assimilated in the drama. The third defect is, most probably it is also for this last reason that descriptive poetry, that is the poetry of nature, has also been ignored. The fourth defect, comedy and epic have been slightly and cursorily retreated, cursorily. Fifth defect is, the larger part of the discussion is devoted to tragedy, but here too the attention has been focused on the nature of the plot and the effects of tragedy. Tragedy was regarded in the age as the form in which all earlier poetry culminated, and this accounts for the excessive importance which Aristotle attaches to it. In this respect, as in many others, Aristotle was displaying contemporary influences and limitations. The sixth defect is, the style is telegraphic and highly concentrated. A style for the initiated, that is for those who were already familiar with the author's terminology and thought. The poetics is not self-explanatory and self-sufficient. it must constantly be interpreted by the other works of Greek philosopher, more especially his Ethics, Politics, and the Lost Dialogue on the Poet. The seventh defect is, it is a work obviously not meant for publication. There are irregularities and anomalies, constant digressions, omissions, contradictions, repetitions, showing haste and lack of revision. Eighth defect is, often there are signs of hesitation and uncertainty in the use of terminology. The ninth one is, Aristotle's theories are not wholly the result of free and dispassionate reflection. His views are conditioned by contemporary social and literary influences. They are based on earlier theories and are also conditioned by the fact that he had to confute certain theories current at the time. The main trend of his argument is determined by Plato's attack upon poetry. Aristotle takes up the challenge of Plato at the end of Republic 10 and proceeds to establish the superiority of poetry over philosophy and its educational value. Much of it is in the nature of a special pleading on behalf of poetry, and so has all the defects of such an advocacy. The tenth defect is, even to an accomplished scholar, the meaning is often obscure. The difficulty is further increased by the fact that the average reader is not familiar with the Greek language, its idiom, syntax, and grammar. Interpretations differ from critic to critic, to the great confusion and bewilderment of the student. BEWILDERMENT. The 11th defect is, Aristotle's theories are based exclusively on Greek poetry and drama with which he was familiar. Many of his views have grown outdated and unfit for universal application. The next subheading in this chapter is its real greatness. Despite these defects, the Poetics is an epoch-making work, a work which is a storehouse of literary theories, one of the great world books, a book whose influence has been continuous and universal. Some of the more important reasons of its greatness are, first, Aristotle discards the earlier oracular method in which critical pronouncements were supposed to be the result of some prophetic insight. He also discards Plato's dialectic method, that is, the use of dialogue, as inadequate for arriving at a positive and coherent statement of truth. Second, the Greek philosopher starts from concrete facts, that is, existing Greek poetry, and through analysis of facts arrives at his principles and generalizations, for which, like a scientist, he claims no finality. His methods are exploratory and tentative. It is an attempt to arrive at the truth rather than the assertion of some preconceived notions. As Gilbert Murray points out, Gilbert Murray, GILBERTMURRAY, it is a first attempt made by a man of astounding genius to build up in the region of creative art a rational order like that he had already established in the region of the physical sciences. Third, throughout he studies poetry in relation to man. He traces it back to the fundamental instincts of human nature, that is, the instinct of imitation and the instinct for harmony. Thus, his method of inquiry is psychological. It is the first psychological study of the poetic process. Tragedy he justifies by its emotional effects. The fourth point is, in the Poetics, Aristotle also originates the historical method of inquiry. He notes different phases in the evolution of Greek poetry, and thus his work becomes a starting point for subsequent literary histories. Fifth point is, though Aristotle never claimed any finality for his principles, yet says Atkins, the miracle of the Poetics is that it contains so much that is permanent and universal interest. And this is so because the literature on which it was based was no artificial product of a sophisticated society, but the natural expression of a race guided solely by what was elemental in human nature. The sixth part is, the work is full of ideas that are as true today as they were when it was written. The seventh point is, Aristotle's greatness lies in the fact that he raised the essential problems, though he was not always successful in providing solutions. The Poetics is thought-provoking. It is a great irritant to thought. Aristotle asks the right type of questions, and literary theory has grown and advanced by seeking answers to Aristotle's questions. The next subheading in this chapter is its universal significance. For all these reasons, the Poetics is an important landmark in the history of literary criticism. It is the most significant thing for the study of literature that has come down to us from Greek civilization. First of all, it represents the final judgment of the Greeks themselves upon two, and perhaps the leading two, Hellenic inventions, epic poetry and tragic drama. Aristotle has systematized and completed the work of his predecessors with great independence of judgment. The brief treatise is important, secondly, because directly or indirectly it has commanded more attention than any other book of literary criticism, so that the course of literary history, after it is not intelligible without an acquaintance with the Poetics at the first hand, whether in the original or through a translation. But further, the work has a permanent value, quite apart from historical considerations. Aristotle's fundamental assumptions and the generalizations upon which he mainly insists are as true of any modern literature as they are of his own. That a work of art, for instance, a drama or the like, may be compared to a living organism, every part of whose structure is essential for the function of the whole, is a connection having validity for all ages. And the same may also be said of his contention that poetry has its own standard of correctness or fitness and is to be judged primarily by its own laws. The Poetics is further valuable for its method and perspective. Simply and directly, it lays emphasis on what is of first importance, upon the vital structure of a poem rather than the meter, upon the end and aim of tragedy in its effect upon the emotions rather than on the history of the chorus. Profound thoughts are expressed in language suited to a scientific inquiry, starting with the Platonic assumption that a literary form or an oration, for example, or a tragedy has the nature of a living organism, Aristotle advances to the position that each distinct kind of literature must have a definite and characteristic activity or function. Then further, beginning again with the general literary estimates that had become more or less crystallized during the interval between the age of the Attic drama and his own time, he selects out of a large extent literature a small number of tragedies which must necessarily conform more nearly than rest to ideal type. By a penetrating scrutiny of these crucial instances in tragedy, he defines the proper effect of this kind of literature upon ideal spectator, namely the effect which he terms the catharsis of pity and fear, the purgation of two disturbing emotions. The reasoning from function back to form and from form again to function, he tests each select tragedy and every part of it by the way in which the part and the whole conducted to this emotional relief. In this manner, he arrives at the conception of an ideal structure for tragedy, a pattern which, though never fully realized in any existing Greek drama, must yet constitute the standard for all of its kind. Finally, the poetics, if it be sympathetically studied, may be thought to have a special value at the present time when a school has arisen led by Professor Croce, whose view is that there really are no types in art and hence no standards of interpretation and criticism save the aim of the individual writer or painter. In his Essays of Education, Milton alludes to some antidote in one part of the literature to an evil tendency in another. Whenever the poetics of Aristotle receives the attention it demands, it serves as an antidote to anarchy in criticism. And finally, the next subheading is conclusion. To conclude with the words of Gilbert Murray, the book is of permanent value as a mere intellectual achievement, as a store of information about Greek literature, and as an original or first-hand statement of what we may call the classical view of artistic criticism. It doesn't regard poetry as a matter of unanalyzed inspiration. It makes no concession to personal whims of fashion or ennui, ennui. It tries by rational methods to find out what is good in art and what makes it good, accepting the belief that there is just as truly as good way and many bad ways in poetry as in morals or in playing billiards, B-I-L-L-A-R-D-S. This is no place to try to sum up its main conclusions, but it is characteristic of the classical view that Aristotle lays his greatest stress first on the need of the unity in a work of art, the need that each part should subserve the whole, while irrelevancies, however brilliant in themselves, should be cast away, and next on the demand that great art must have for its subject the great way of living. These judgments have often been misunderstood, but the truth in them is profound and goes near to the heart of things. In short, the Poetics is not only the first truly philosophical discussion of literature, but the foundation of all subsequent discussions.